Hello, everyone. Good morning. Thank you for attending our session today. The title is Greening Up, Better Work in the Just Transition. I'm Jimmy Greer. I'm Head of Sustainability at ACCA, the Association for Chartered Certified Accountants. For those of you who don't know us, as a professional body, we operate in over 179 countries with over 200,000 members and over 500,000 students globally. In the UK, we have 80,000 members working in all sectors and businesses of all sizes. We're passionate about promoting growth beyond London and the Southeast, and we work hard to ensure opportunity to our members is universal. We're super grateful to have the Shadow Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, Ed Miliband, joining us today, as well as our brilliant guest speakers, Yanpei Chen, my colleague from ACCA, Catherine Howard, CEO of ShareAction, and Miriam Brett from Commonwealth. Before we move on to opening remarks, and I don't really want to tee up the panel too much because I think we just want to get into it. You don't want to hear from me. If you would like to submit a question, please do. We really would love questions to make this as interactive as possible once we've heard the opening remarks from people. So in terms of running order, I'm going to first pass over to Ed, then to Yanpei, Catherine, and then to Miriam, and then we'll open up for discussion and take it from there. So Ed, over to you.
Jimmy, and I'm really looking forward to this event with such an interesting panel of people and such an interesting subject. I guess my sort of starting point in this is we're in the middle of a massive economic crisis, and we are obviously, given what's been announced in the last 24 hours, the path for what's gonna happen next is very uncertain. And there's a massively important rescue phase where we've got to save as many businesses and jobs as possible. And Labour has spent, as you will know, and the audience will know, quite a lot of time arguing. Now, I think the government is starting to show signs that it gets it, for an extension of the furlough in some form or another to save businesses and jobs. And this is really sort of, you know, this is an absolutely sort of critical thing now, because we're, from what Boris Johnson said yesterday, you know, we're in this for at least 6 months. But then, sort of beyond that, and I guess this is our focus today. Beyond that, there's a question about rescue, but there's also a question about recovery. How do we recover? And my case, our case, is that there is no better way for us to promote recovery, to promote jobs, than a green recovery. A green recovery, because we know it works from all the work by Nick Stern and others, that it can get money out the door and get jobs in our economy, because I think there is a real desire to build back better. You know, people have been through so much in this crisis. The least we owe people is to understand the lessons of this crisis and create better lives. And this is a really important point about my sort of environmentalism. You know, I think often we talk about avoiding disaster, and of course we've got to avoid disaster, but this is about creating better lives for people, whether it's jobs or air quality or green spaces, all of those things. And so I think on building back better grounds, it makes sense. And also value for money grounds. We've got to do this anyway, because as a country, we've got this massive transition that we face. And what am I looking for from government? I'm looking for scale, because when you look at what France is doing, what Germany is doing, it's the tens of billions of euros. We're still in the billions of pounds. We need to step up. It's about breadth. Yes, it's about retrofit. Yes, it's about zero carbon engines. It's also about the green spaces. It's about the tree planting. It's about the care jobs, which I think are a part of the future of the green economy. It's about a broad approach and a broad and inclusive approach to what a green recovery can do. And then crucially, and maybe this is sort of implicit in the title of this session, we've got to make sure that these green jobs are produced in a way that is fair, and that is fair to the people benefiting from them sort of indirectly, if you like. So on retrofit, that we make sure that retrofit takes place in social housing, but it's also about the workers in those industries. To be self-critical about it, I think sometimes in the broad environmental movement, we've sort of thought green automatically means just. Now, green might mean just in climate terms, but it doesn't necessarily mean just in economic or social terms, both in terms of how you raise the money, but also crucially, the nature of the jobs. Is there social partnership in the jobs? Is there a presence of strong trade unions? Are there decent wages? And I don't think we can just sort of assume those things away and say, well, because it's green, it's obviously going to be fair and just. And so I think we've really got to pay attention to that. I think partly because, and this is, I guess, the point I want to to sort of end on. You know, we are in the coalition building business in the sense that what is our challenge in relation to the environment? It all sits too much, or climate change, it still sits too much only in an environmental box and isn't seen as being at the heart of economic and social justice. It's got to be at the heart of economic and social justice. It can't just be seen as a middle class issue. It's got to build into working class communities like the one I represent in Doncaster to say, you know, this is about a better future for people in this community. This is about how we are going to change this community. And then I'll end on this point, which is just to think back to 1945. And I know the 1945 stuff is overdone, but I think it's a point worth emphasizing. What did they do after the Second World War? They said, constrained circumstances, deep, deep economic difficulties are not going to make us lower our sights. It's going to make us raise our sights. Raise our sights to what kind of country we can build. And you know, honestly, I think this is absolutely where we need to be as we think about the future beyond this crisis. Because yes, it's grim times at the moment, and it's obviously going to be grim times for some time to come. But, you know, we owe it to ourselves to understand the lessons of this, as I said, and to build something better. And I honestly think that absolutely at the core of this is a green recovery and tackling the climate crisis at the centre.
Thank you, Ed, and thanks for those brilliant opening remarks. I think that sets us up really nicely for our panelists as we dig into those questions around breadth, around livability, but also livelihoods and livability together, and kind of and broadening the movement and getting it into economic and social justice areas. I'm now going to pass over to my colleague Yenpei Chen. Yenpei, from your side and the research and policy work, research work that you've been doing over the years at ACCA, looking at fairness of tax systems and those kind of issues, I'd really like to turn to you and sort of find out from you a little bit about your response in that space.
Thank you, Jimmy. I want to start by saying that we really need systemic change. As many people have already mentioned, the coronavirus crisis has only shone a light on brutal realities that we were already aware of, the inequalities in this country. And those inequalities are only going to get worse. I'm not talking about Brexit right now, but rather the technological changes that's happening in our workplaces. Many of the workers that are worst affected by our COVID-19 are also those who stand to have the most to lose as technology advances. The OECD estimates that in the UK, 11% of jobs in the UK are likely to be entirely replaced by automation, and 26% more could see significant change. And these are jobs that we've become quite familiar with in recent days: cleaners, bus drivers, transport workers, Uber drivers, construction workers. So how do we protect them? And in the meanwhile, of course, the climate crisis isn't going away. Even as in June, we marveled at the clear skies, the Arctic Circle registered its highest temperature ever at 38 degrees. So just as Ed said, I think we need to take green policies out of its environment box and really start linking environmental policies and social policies together. And now I want to talk to you about tax, not only because it's an area that I work in, I feel passionate about, but I do believe the tax system can be and should be part of the solution. If any of you is surprised by this, then it's probably worth remembering the three basic functions of tax. So taxes influence behavior, they raise public revenues, which are important these days, and they also redistribute wealth. So taken all of these three together, I think it's quite clear that taxes are relevant to our green recovery. In 2018, ACCA published this report called Tax as a Force for Good. And in it, we asked a simple question. So we know we want to get more people into stable employment, and we want to reduce pollution. So why are we taxing employment income significantly more than we're taxing pollution? Can we adopt instead a principle of taxing more what we want less of? So might surprise you to find that the latest set of data from the OECD shows that labor taxes represented 45% of the UK's total tax revenue in 2018. And by contrast, environmental taxes made up just 6%. In 2019, while we were still in the EU, the UK gave the highest level of funding for fossil fuel among EU member states. So that's 10.5 billion more than the funding that was made available to support renewable energy. So it seems only reasonable to try to redress this balance now. And perhaps now is a good time to do so, because coming from the pandemic crisis that we've all been in, businesses, just like the government, are also having to have a fundamental rethink about the way they operate. Some businesses will need to redesign their business models, and certainly energy companies faced with plummeting oil prices are having to do that. We've also got more companies setting internal carbon prices to help guide their decision making. And some have even started to estimate the impact of a 2-degree scenario on their operating profit. Of course, in business, we do say that what gets measured gets managed. And thinking about this mantra, this is why we need tax policies to help accelerate this change in business decision making. You know, it can be quite difficult to estimate the financial impact of, say, disruption to the supply chain due to a climate event of uncertain probability. I mean, even though in recent months, that's probably got a bit easier. But certainly, it's a whole lot easier to estimate the financial effect of, say, an introduction of a new carbon tax or the reduction of the rate of national insurance. We've talked about mitigating downsides, but there are also areas of opportunity as well. Areas such as circular business models that actively design waste and pollution out of business processes and make sure that materials can be reused again and again. The reason why I think circular business models is an area of opportunity that policymakers should absolutely support is, I suppose, there are three reasons. First, circular businesses are labor intensive, and this is what we need to help to close our large jobs gap in the fallout of COVID-19. They also tend to be local because they, by nature, they need to be closer to their end customers. So that also means that there are opportunities for circular hubs to develop outside of the big cities, so regions can also benefit from the upside. And finally, it's open to small businesses. Actually, a lot of the major innovations in circular models have been driven by small entrepreneurial business. But there's a catch, because we need government policy to change for circular business models to be viable. The high labor costs can be a real barrier to scaling up circular businesses. And so it's particularly problematic today when labor taxes are high and pollution is subsidized. So if we turn it the other way around, and we increase taxes on pollution, reduce taxes on labor, we can help circular businesses to thrive while also protecting local employment and help the whole country to benefit from the economic opportunities that a green recovery or a carbon transition can bring. So I just want to end by taking three asks to the policymakers in this virtual room, and in particular Ed, and they're very simple. First is to phase out fossil fuel subsidies in consultation with businesses and consumers. Second is to reduce labor taxes while increasing social protection. And third, support circular business models. Thank you.
Yenpei, and I know all the work you've been doing on thinking about taxation and circular together, and that's a great summary, but I know there's so much underneath that, and I'd urge everyone to read our report, Tax as a Force for Good, that Yenpei mentioned, which has got a lot of examples, and it's a really brilliant piece of work. I now want to pass over to Catherine Howard, Chief Executive of Share Action. Catherine, from your side and of the amazing breadth of work that you cover at Share Action, through the research, the campaigns, and thinking about the financial system and the different actors there, really interested to bring you in now and think about your views on how we can support this transition in a way that is just and has that breadth and the livability and all the different levers that need to be pulled that Ed was mentioning.
Thanks, Jimmy, and thanks for inviting me to be part of this brilliant conversation. So I want to start off by just probably just re-emphasizing some of the the points that have already been made. And then I'm going to segue into talking about some of the leverage points that we have, for example, particularly through the UK's enormous pension fund industry, to drive the green recovery and the jobs-rich recovery that we need in the UK. So I just really want to begin with emphasising the incredible broad benefits that flow from concerted, ambitious climate action. First and foremost, it's a jobs-rich agenda. Well, I'll talk about the quality of jobs, because as Ed says, we can't take it for granted that those are good jobs, and we have to insist on that and build standards around that. But there is extraordinary opportunity for millions of new jobs in our economy by being very ambitious on green. It's also a health-focused agenda, as Ed has also said. We really, air pollution is killing millions of people, and it's you know, here in London, I've got my kids in a primary school where air pollution's a real issue. So cleaning up and going to a decarbonised urban environment is incredibly good for all of our health. It obviously protects against the risks of extreme weather events that are coming down the track. And I think the UK, as a mid-sized economy on the global stage, you know, big-ish, but not in the top echelons, can, by setting the standard around this, show global leadership that ultimately has international sway and helps ensure that we achieve the kind of global climate transition that we alone cannot make, but we can show that leadership. And the UK has obviously done that for many years. And I think there are mixed signs that this government is serious about it too. But I just want to come back to emphasising the need to design in decent work from the get-go in green industries. It is not a given at all. In fact, the old dying industries, oil, gas and coal, had a mixed record on employment, but often were good unionised jobs, blue-collar jobs. And it's far from clear that the new green industries are going to put decent work right at the core of their kind of vision for growth. And we need policy and we need pressure that makes sure that green jobs are good jobs. I'm just going to flag up for a second the kind of BP, one of the UK's largest companies, is really setting out a very visionary agenda of change. And that's both got a place-based piece to it, like their decarbonising Teesside agenda, which is really very exciting, very positive. But it's also kind of a systems-wide approach. And Yenpei talked about the need for kind of truly systemic change. And I applaud what BP is doing to commit to becoming effectively an integrated energy company, which is net zero by 2050, and moving away from being an oil and gas behemoth. So, but it's got to put, and it's not clear that investors in BP are asking for this, it's got to put good jobs right at the heart of that transition story. Just transition needs to rest on social dialogue, and working people have to have a say in how we transition. And I think Labour Party has got an incredibly key role in ensuring that we design in and build the kind of policy frameworks and the opportunities for people to have a voice right from the get-go with all of that. So let me turn to the opportunity set to bring about this vision of clean growth that puts people and jobs and social justice right at the heart of the green transition story. I think our pension funds, millions of pension fund members in the UK, can be right at the heart of it. There's been already a transition or a transformation in the pension fund industry over the last 10 years, and Labour introduced pensions automatic enrolment, and that has transformed the demographic of pension savers in the UK from being effectively a kind of middle-aged, middle-class, better-paid senior men who were the typical pension fund members of 10 years ago, to being a much larger demographic of British working people, younger, more female and more low-paid. But we still have to transition the thinking inside the UK's pension fund industry to ensure that in pursuing investment strategies, they meet the economic interests of that changed demographic. So I think a good jobs agenda should be right at the heart of what every pension fund with holdings across the economy and lots of different companies in this country and across the world should put kind of good jobs right at the heart of the role it plays in overseeing the companies in those portfolios. There's a big opportunity right now when lots of companies are looking for recovery finance, and they're not just looking to the public sector and the Treasury for recovery finance. They're absolutely looking to pension funds and asset managers that look after our savings. And so there's an opportunity for quid pro quo in return for refinancing and recapitalization of companies that need to recover at this time and need new capital to kind of build back. There needs to be conditions. That financing is conditional on companies having a jobs rich transition plan. So every company in our pension portfolios, the directors of those companies who look each year for re-election by our pension funds, and they should be asked by our pension funds to produce their low carbon transition plans, and for those transition plans to be really clear on what kind of employers do these companies intend to be as they take us through that transition. Pension funds have the opportunity to ask really tough questions about whether it's the executive directors or the workforce getting more of a look in when they use our money, and particularly when they're looking for new recovery finance. So I think there's a massive opportunity for working people, the institutions that look after working people's capital, to help shape jobs-rich green recovery that we need right now. And then I'm just going to end on just flagging up a couple of the kind of right now policy opportunities to put all this in place. So there's a pensions bill, which is just cranking up in Parliament. It's already gone through the Lords, and a number of peers were instrumental with support, I should say, from Share Action in getting the government to commit to amendments that have put climate change right at the heart of that new pensions bill. But now that bill is coming to the Commons, and there's an opportunity to put, you know, new amendments in that put the voice of pension fund members and the interests of pension fund members much more at the heart of the way we run our pension schemes in the UK. So the pensions bill is one. I think people have talked about sovereign green bonds. There's a really big opportunity for the UK to issue green bonds that not only finance green transition, but put jobs right at the heart of that vision. And then finally, there's the whole range of things that the business department is responsible for. And Ed is in a brilliant position to challenge the business secretary. So that department is responsible for the stewardship agenda, which is right at the heart of the role investors play in overseeing companies. And things like annual general meetings, which have been completely sort of turned upside down by coronavirus and social distancing, meant we couldn't really have AGMs in the normal way. But now everyone's looking at what's the future of the AGM. Can we have AGMs that represent stakeholder interest, that bring workers' interest as well as shareholders into a dialogue with board directors? I think there's a kind of exciting opportunity to look at modernizing AGMs coming out of this pandemic. So lots of things that we could do and Labour can be involved in to keep this government on its toes and make sure we get green growth that puts working people at the heart of the vision.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for all of those fantastic areas that you touched on, showing so many possibilities for action now. Conditionality, I think, is so interesting. And we've seen some, you know, we were just talking yesterday about conditionality on financing in Canada for companies to disclose on their climate risks. If they wanted to access recovery funds, for example, you know, those kind of things are innovations which are able to be done in the here and now to meet this crisis. So many things there. I'm sure we'll come back to many in our sort of discussion. I now want to pass on to Miriam. Miriam Brett, your Director of Research and Advocacy at Commonwealth. It's so great to have Commonwealth as part of our panel. And I'd like to just hand over straight to you if I can.
So yeah, I think first on your point around kind of interweaving and twin goals of climate justice and economic justice, I think if our recovery is to be resilient and be sustainable, we need to tackle both of these at once. And there's huge benefits to doing so. There's obviously a climate benefit to doing this. There's a societal benefit to doing this. There's a clear economic benefit to doing this as well. I think recently, in particular with the development and the discussion around the Green New Deal, which really does root both of those twin goals at its core, there has been an enormous amount of progress in terms of understanding how complementary both of those are, because in my eyes, our unequal and extractive economy is driving climate breakdown and the exacerbating levels of inequality in our society. And we see that, you know, we see that through the distribution, the uneven distribution of carbon emissions, of carbon consumption patterns. And that is really reflected in terms of the kind of makeup of our economy as well, particularly when we look at the uneven distribution of carbon emissions of some of the most largest conglomerate corporations. So I think particularly now when we're looking at the recovery, what type of recovery do we want to see? What type of action do we need to take just now? That kind of twin goals of climate justice and economic justice need to be interwoven in our response to this crisis through a large green fiscal stimulus package that actually can bring about the type of job creation, good, decent, well-paid, secure jobs that we need just now in areas like retrofitting homes, in areas like nature restoration, tree planting, peatland restoration. All of those go to tackle both of those goals simultaneously, and they are societal, there are climate, there are environmental, there are economic benefits to that. I think on your point on social partnerships is a really brilliant one about kind of who's involved in this decision making, who's driving this change. For me, I was really interested in the development of the LEAP manifesto in Canada a few years ago, which was I think spearheaded by Naomi Klein among others. And one of the things that it aimed to do was to bring together voices from unions and voices from climate campaigners to look at what a just transition would actually look like. And it actually brings together oil workers, for example, and union representatives from oil companies, which is, for me, exactly the sort of conversations we should be having. It's about bringing together different voices in the room, ensuring that workers are represented, ensuring that those who are facing the negative consequences of the current economic kind of model are represented in that room and are part of the decision-making process going forward. On your point about assemblies, I think that could be an incredibly brilliant way to actually bring together exactly those sorts of voices. And we've seen in Scotland the development of a citizens' assembly, and I think that would be a really positive thing to see throughout the UK as well.
Ed, I want to come back to you directly, actually, just if you've got some observations of the points that were made, but also, I guess, from our side, Yenpei, I know you're going to share some more details. I'm sure you'll share some more details on tax systems as well. But Ed, maybe some reflections on the points that have been made, but also this thing about how do we make sure that places aren't left behind? I mean, Catherine mentioned that great example, actually, of trying to take that more systems, place-based approach. You know, these social mobility cold spots are persistent. You know, they're entrenched. So what are the practical steps to take to make sure places aren't left behind again?
It's a really good question, Jimmy, and I really enjoyed the contributions that we've heard, which were incredibly thought-provoking, and I particularly struck by what Catherine said about the sort of opportunity there is in relation to the stewardship agenda. She and I have talked about this over a number of years, and I think it's a really, really well-taken point. I was also interested to hear her praise for BP, which is noted, and I will obviously look into the project that she mentioned. I mean, I suppose, Jimmy, to answer your question directly, what do we do to make sure that people aren't excluded? I prefer the word excluded to left behind. I'd say a couple of things. First of all, there are aspects to this which are genuinely nationwide programs which can promote employment right across the country. So if you take the example of retrofit, and I know retrofit is now sort of, it's almost become a cliche. If we really did house by house, street by street transition plan, which is what I think we need, for my constituents in Doncaster, it would mean lots of jobs. We don't know exactly how many, but it's probably hundreds of thousands of jobs across the country, definitely significant number of jobs in Doncaster. So I think I'll come on to the sort of more targeted approaches in a second, because that's important. But I think a sort of nationwide approach, you could start in the areas that most need the employment. The only comparison with this is the town that I've heard is the town gas to natural gas transition in the 60s and 70s, which even I can't remember. So I think the first thing is government has got to sort of step up and think ambitiously, as I think all of us have said in different ways, about what this program looks like. And you can definitely start it in the areas that most need employment. That's the first thing. Then secondly, there is definitely scope for targeting additional programs that are going to be needed by the country at areas that face particular challenges. I was a big promoter when I was the Energy Secretary of carbon capture and storage. There was a sort of £1 billion competition that we did, which then got cancelled by the next government. It would actually have been, could have potentially included my area. It was certainly a plan that could have worked in Yorkshire. So I think thinking through how you target those programs at the areas most in need absolutely is something that government should be doing and could be doing. And I suppose then to sort of round up, it's this combination of the universal and the targeted that we need. Because similarly, green spaces could be a massive thing too. We in Doncaster, I'm chairing a climate commission in Doncaster on behalf of the local council. And, you know, we are thinking every town and city is going to need to change. I mean, it was sort of in everybody's contribution in a way, walking, cycling, the role of cars, all of, you know, so in a sense, I think the opportunities are multiple, including for excluded areas excluded by prosperity. I think a lot of this is about imagination and sort of political will to get it done.
Thanks, Ed. I think that's great. And I think that example of retrofit, I mean, it's right in front of us, right? And I think, you know, from some of the work that we've been doing on the finance side, thinking about how that might sink into green mortgages, for example. And, you know, there's a sort of systems-wide approach which can actually sort of, let's call it, increase returns in a certain way, the kind of social and environmental returns. But yeah, loads of things in there. Thank you so much for that, Ed. I just want to come back to YenPay quickly on something that you were mentioning. We talked a bit about green taxes. Can you just explain a bit, what do you mean when we say green taxes? Just, you know, because we're lucky to have you with us and you spend a lot of time looking at these issues. Can you tell us about, you know, what do we mean by green taxes, the terminology, and also linked to that, subsidies as well on fossil fuels and things like that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Jimmy. Green taxes cover a very wide range of different taxes, and that's why I think we do need to see them as sort of working in an interconnected way. So that goes from, for example, VAT on fuel, be it transport fuel or domestic fuel, VAT on energy consumption, fuel duty, of course, petroleum taxes, and a whole range of things. And that means different taxes fall on different populations. Some of those taxes fall on businesses. Landfill tax is one that I should mention that is actually a very successful example of a tax that has successfully achieved its sort of behavior changing objective. And so they fall on different populations, businesses, or households, and they have different levels of breadth. So all of these taxes need to be thought about in the round. Now, going on to fossil fuel subsidies, of course, that is an area where I think a lot of transparency is lacking. The government maintains that there are no fossil fuel subsidies in the UK. But again, these link back to our green taxes. A lot of it comes from reduced rates of tax on domestic energy consumption. It also comes from sort of tax reliefs for companies in oil and gas, things like loss relief or R&D credits. And then I've mentioned before the petroleum tax, which is at 0% right now. The reason why it's 0%, the difference between 0% and exempt, is that you can still use the losses that you accumulate potentially year on year to reduce taxes in the future. That's, it would seem, a very obvious way. If we are talking about phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, things like petroleum tax, things like the fossil fuel duty that's been frozen since 2011, despite continued signals that that's going to go up, they would be candidates, very easy candidates to address. If I may, actually hearing Ed and Catherine also on sort of making sure that the green recovery works in all places in the UK, I think one issue that probably needs to be touched upon are sort of the challenges that are facing people in the gig economy. That is a form of work that's just growing exponentially right now and will only continue to grow. We should see the COVID-19 crisis continue. And how to protect these people who have no access to pension plans and zero job security, zero access to retraining for skills, for the opportunities in the green economy, certainly one I think we need to think about carefully.
And I was just going to say, you know, linked to that, you mentioned the stewardship code, Catherine, and obviously there are other things such as articles of association and looking to change the way companies are structured as well, so that they are thinking about these things, particularly linked to work and providing all of those areas. And I often think, we mentioned care earlier. Care is an area that when we were all thinking a lot about automation as being a sector which was very hard to automate for obvious reasons, there was very little thinking at that time that actually about the kind of agency work related aspects of that. and the fairness of the kind of work agenda. It was a very sort of techno discussion, which was very one-sided and all of those things. I'm really glad you brought that into the picture, Yenpei. Catherine, perhaps I could come back to you if you had any sort of comments on what others had said, and also thinking about that sort of, I think there's some questions around collaboration. You know, how do we get people's views and voices in as well? And I guess from your side, how do investors in their broadest sense, you mentioned it a bit about reforming the AGM, building these conversations so that they're meaningful and have impact across a wide group of stakeholders. You guys have been doing it for so long, and I just wonder if you had any other sort of top asks in that space.
Let me just pick up on Yenpei's point about the gig economy, because I really want to emphasize it. I think it's really scary what's going on, and obviously we're at one of those kind of really vulnerable moments where people kind of think, well, any job's better than no job, and so and people are desperate, and I kind of think that ultimately the solution to that is proper enforcement. We have to pay for the agencies of government and agencies of state that are responsible for things like minimum wage enforcement, and we need kind of to reimagine what regulation of the labour market looks like in the context of these kind of new models of digitised exploitation. It's really scary. Now, there is definitely a role for investors in those companies to be asking the right questions. And the point I was really trying to make earlier is that the biggest investment funds in our economy are workers' capital in pension schemes. And when you ask workers what they think is an important agenda in terms of the stewardship of their assets that they month after month in good faith put into a pension scheme, two topics come out really high. People are absolutely interested in green, sustainable climate action from the companies in their pension fund, and they're very, very interested in the companies that they invest in being decent employers. That's really not very surprising. But nevertheless, the pension fund industry and its agents across the asset management world and in the hedge fund world and in the private equity world have not put those issues high on the agenda. Care sector is a really interesting example. The care sector has a huge number of private equity players who put, you know, workers' well-being very, very low down the list of things that they were focused on. And pension funds are invested in those private equity vehicles and not asking enough good questions. So I think there's a real opportunity to sort of get that right. And, you know, the UK has just issued a new stewardship code earlier this year, which is globally leading. And it's an incredibly, I really commend everybody to have a look at the 2020 stewardship code. It's a fantastic document. It's soft law, soft regulation. Investors don't have to apply by it, but it's good practice. And most UK pension funds and their asset managers, I think over the next 12 to 24 months, will be compelled to sign up in a kind of soft pressure way to sign up to the stewardship code, which puts workers' issues and climate issues much more central than in the old stewardship code, which really just focused on corporate governance issues. So I'm actually quite optimistic that we've got a lot of the architecture in place to get this right, but we certainly need a Labour Party in opposition keeping the government feet to the fire around all of these issues, both because we just need decent regulation and because we can use these other sort of channels and vehicles, like making sure that we have a UK investment industry that really puts workers and environmental standards high on the agenda of companies across the world.
Can I ask you a question, if Jimmy will allow me? And let's say we made you the BEIS secretary, just for the sake of argument. I think you'd be an excellent BEIS secretary.
Thank you.
Personally, what would you do in relation to the stewardship code that isn't being done already?
Look, we've got this brand new code, and so I think that we have a lot. I wouldn't necessarily dive straight in to make that code mandatory. Let's see how it goes. I think there are opportunities. I'm actually doing a piece of work for the Treasury at the moment on the future of stewardship, and we're looking at things like making all the government-backed investment organisations, which is local government pension schemes, which are things like UK government investments, really putting the pressure on that they sign up to the stewardship code. So the government at least is putting its invested assets and pension funds that it underwrites in the form of the local government pension scheme.
Dare I ask, do you know if the House of Commons has signed up to the 2020 stewardship?
Very good question, Ed. I don't know the answer. You're a member of the scheme, so maybe you could find out.
Caroline Lucas and I have been pressing on this for many years on this kind of issue. Anyway, I will check.
She is brilliant, and she's done amazing about, along with you and a number of other MPs and ex-MPs who are members of the scheme, to push on climate elements. I hope and believe that the pension scheme is signed up to the old stewardship code. There's now a brilliant opportunity to make sure that they're in the first tier of organisations that sign up, whose names will be announced in the coming months, who are signed up to the new code.
Thanks, Catherine, and thanks for coming back. Thanks, Ed, for jumping in there. You're very welcome to jump in and ask the panellists questions if you have any. We've come to the end of this discussion. I'm sure we could carry on a lot longer on loads of things. Nature-based solutions that you brought up is a really interesting area. Ed, thank you for diving into the comments as well. We're very grateful for doing that. There's a question on aviation fuels. I think alt fuels more broadly are so interesting. Ed, can I just hand over to you for just 1 second? I know we're running very short on time, but if you had just final word just for the panel and for participants.
First of all, Jimmy, can I thank you and ACCA for making this session possible? I've certainly learned a lot. One specific comment, one general comment. Specific comment that we've not covered so far, consumption emissions versus production emissions. I think this is really important. Unless we start measuring what we consume and taking it seriously as well as what we produce, there's going to be an inbuilt bias, I'm afraid, towards offshoring manufacturing and doing so in a way that is not going to make the climate agenda be met. I mean, I think I've become more and more seized of the idea that both for justice reasons, global justice reasons, and for kind of local justice reasons, or national justice reasons, we need to make consumption emissions much more central to the way we think about these issues. The more general point, Jimmy, is just to thank you and the panelists, as I say, but also to say to people who maybe haven't had their question answered on the chat, please continue the dialogue with Labour, with me and my team. I've got a good team of people, Alan Whitehead, who's our Shadow Energy Minister, Matt Pennycook, who's a Shadow Climate Minister, as well as my advisors and so on, and theirs. And we're really keen to carry on the conversation, and through the Labour Party channels, I hope people will do that.
We're going to wrap up now. I really appreciate you taking the time, and to all the participants who joined us online, thank you. So I really appreciate your time. Thanks, everyone.